Speaker, sir, may I first join the Right Honourable Gentleman in warmly congratulating my honourable friends, the Member for Pudsey and for Lewisham West, on the most excellent speeches they made in moving and in seconding the Loyal Address. My honourable friend, the Member for Pudsey, is famous for his wit and affability, and his performance was even better than his reputation today. It was an absolutely marvellous speech. I noticed that he was typically modest in his own contribution to government. We miss him very much, but one of the advantages of his being on the backbenches is that we are able to hear him, that we are able to hear him in this most excellent loyal address today. May I also congratulate my honourable friend, the Member for Lewisham West, on a typically persuasive and very thorough speech. Enjoyed it very much. I have a very fellow feeling with him being a London member, particularly because we suffer from rape in the health service, as he knows well. It was a most excellent speech, and I too
order.
Will
order.
Keep his seat for as long as I have kept mine.
Order. Well, order. May I say to the House that I did not wish to interrupt the Leader of the Opposition in his speech, but I say to those below the gangway, will they kindly refrain from chatting to their friends across the gate and remain quiet and listen to the speeches. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, may I turn to some of the comments which the Right Honourable Gentleman made and go through some of them quickly before making my own remarks on the gracious speech. With regard to pensioners, there are now far fewer pensioners on low incomes today than there were 10 years ago. If you take the bottom one-fifth of national income, then 10 years ago, 38% of pensioners were in that bottom fifth. Today, only 24% of pensioners are in that bottom fifth, an enormous improvement. With regard to electricity prices, domestic electricity costs 8.1% less in real terms today than it did 5 years ago. But it is quite misleading for the Right Honourable Gentleman to suggest that we can have all of the environmental improvements, all of the improvements on electricity quality and water quality without having to pay the price. Of course there is a price to environmental improvement, and we should in fact believe that it is a very good price to pay. With regard to the environment, may I point out that on the North Sea Conference, which we held in this country, there was a report by scientific experts before that North Sea conference. That report confirmed that the state of the North Sea was generally good and that environment... scientific experts... and that environmental damage was largely confined to localised areas such as the German and Dutch Wadden Seas. And if people are interested in cleanliness of rivers, perhaps they might turn their attention to cleaning up the Rhine. With regard to the RUC, may I point out that in 1986-87, the expenditure for the RUC was £319 million. Mr. Speaker, I'm answering...
Order! I've drawn attention to those who below the gangway were talking in the speech of the Leader of the Opposition. I now say to those above the gangway, and especially to those who are members of the front bench, that they should not seek to interrupt the Prime Minister in this way.
To the Right Honourable Gentleman.
Point of order.
Through the whole time that my right honourable friend was speaking, there was not only noise from below the gangway, but new noise from the government benches. You've sat here and said nothing. And quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, I do resent the threat that you make to members here on the front. Speaking now.
The It's no question of a threat, but I say to the honourable member, who is a member of the front bench team, that he should set a good example.
Mr. Speaker, the right honourable gentleman referred to the resources available to the RUC. In the year 1986-87, there were £319 million, the resources for the RUC. This year, 88-89, there are £385 million, and next year, something like £414 million. That is a substantial increase in resources to that brave police service. He also referred to the clinical grading of nurses. Almost 500,000 nurses, midwives and health visitors have to be regraded. Nearly £1,000 million was provided for this by the taxpayer, and the overwhelming majority of nurses are very satisfied with their grades. There's a very, very limited amount of trouble, and my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Health, will, of course, be seeing the Royal College of Nurses. I think that most taxpayers will not understand how, when they're provided the amount for that payment, that award in full, that there is still some trouble. Yeah. And we hope that we will get improvement in the health service. The right honourable gentleman finished up with an astonishing claim that things were being more centralised. May I counter what he said very strongly? In taxation, for example, the government is taking a lesser proportion of the national income. He wants the government to take a bigger proportion of the national income. In nationalisation, we are in fact privatising and taking powers away from government to the people. In education, we are giving far more powers to the parents and taking them away from central government. In council houses, we are giving far more opportunity to the people to have capital than he would ever have had. And share ownership,
order,
opportunity going from government to the people. All of these things are a movement of power from central government to the people, giving them far more independence, and independence which right honourable and honourable members opposite cannot stand, because they want people to be totally and utterly dependent on the state for pretty nearly all their needs and wants. Mr. Speaker, I turn now to the gracious speech.
Order. I say now to both sides of the House that if we can't have freedom of speech in this place, well, order, where else can we have it? And we should set an example by listening to each other with silence and with respect. The Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech makes clear the government's determination to hold to firm and successful economic policies. We shall continue to bear down on inflation, to keep firm control of public spending, and to promote enterprise. These are the policies which have brought a period of unparalleled prosperity to the British people. Yeah. Prosperity that has been shared by all income groups. We are now in the 8th successive year of economic growth, averaging over 3%. In terms of output per head in manufacturing, we've not yet caught up with our main competitors. But after two whole decades, the 1960s and 1970s, when the United Kingdom was at the bottom of the growth league, in the 1980s we have climbed to the top of the table. Unemployment's now fallen for 27 months in succession. Over the last year, it has been falling in all regions, and the unemployment rate has fallen faster than in any other major industrial country. And growth has been spread widely across the economy. In particular, manufacturing output is at its highest ever level. These policies have produced extra resources for public spending priorities, like the health service, like pensions, the disabled, scientific research, defence, and the police services. But total public spending, although it is at record levels, now accounts for less than 40% of national income for the first time in over 20 years. The extra spending has been financed soundly, but has been combined with lower tax rates. At the same time, public borrowing has been eliminated, and we are now on target for a budget surplus of some £10,000 million in the current financial year. As a result, the burden of debt interest will fall, thus releasing more resources within the same total of public expenditure for priority programmes. Truly a virtuous circle. The achievements under this government reflect the new vitality of our economy. This year, the number of small businesses is increasing at a rate of nearly 1,000 a week. And since 1980, manufacturing productivity has been growing at over 5% a year. Under the last Labour government, it averaged only just over 1% a year. And buoyant investment we have across all sectors is further strengthening our economic potential. For the public sector, the plans set out in the autumn statement provide an additional £2.25 billion of capital spending next year, taking the total to over £25 billion. For example, there will be £440 million more for public sector housing, £250 million more for water and sewerage investment, taking the total this year to £1,500 million capital investment in water, £220 million more for motorways and trunk roads, taking the total on motorways and trunk roads to £1,310 million capital this year, and £170 million more for the health service. Investment by the private sector has been growing rapidly. Total private investment in 1987 is some £60 billion, was over 15% higher in real terms than in any year under the last Labour government. And now in the first three quarters of 1988, investment by the manufacturing, construction, distribution and financial industries is 13.5% higher than it was in 1987. And with all the talk about investments by overseas businesses in the United Kingdom, let us not forget that British businesses are expanding their overseas holdings and investments at a far higher rate.
Order, order. Prime Minister.
In the 12 months to June of this year, the value of takeovers by overseas companies in this country was some £2,900 million. In the same period, British businesses made over 550 overseas acquisitions with a value of £13,700 million, over four times as much. These are investments that are earning and will continue to earn a big return for Britain as the revenue from North Sea oil diminishes. Industrial profitability.
D'Attandio!
Does she approve of the Australian bid for Scottish and Newcastle and the moving out of Edinburgh of major financial headquarters?
Bid, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, has been referred to the Monopolies Commission, and he's quite well aware that while that reference is on, it would be totally and utterly improper for any minister to make any statement about it at all. Industrial profitability has risen every year since 1981, so business today is able to finance a large part of its investment from retained profits. But the personal sector also needs to save. A lot of attention has rightly been given to the fall in the savings ratio and the increase in personal borrowing. Much of this extra borrowing is by people who are buying their own homes, purchasing shares, insurance policies, and so on. But some of the borrowing has been for the purchase of consumer goods, too many of which are imported, a major factor in the deficit on current account. If savings and investment are to be kept in reasonable balance, borrowing has to be checked so that non-inflationary growth can be sustained. And that's why we've raised interest rates. The higher rates will take a time to have their full effect, both to exert downward pressure on inflation and to help reduce the deficit on trade.
Order! Order!
Of course, higher interest rates are unpopular with some people, although they are good, although they are good for those who save, including many, many millions of old people. But they are the right response, because the defeat of inflation is and will remain the top priority. Mr. Speaker, I turn to the legislative programme. The gracious speech outlines a full programme of legislation. Its main provisions can be summarised under three headings. First, those dealing with industry and commerce. Second, social measures, particularly those concerned with the care, protection and education of children. And third, measures safeguarding the security of the realm, fighting terrorism and combating crime and hooliganism, as such as in the latter case, the Football Spectators Bill. I turn to the first heading, industry and commerce. Under that heading, we have two major privatisation measures, water and electricity. The water bill will be a major environmental measure as well. The bill...
Hold up!
The bill will establish a new public body, the National Rivers Authority, to take over the responsibilities of water authorities in England and Wales in relation to controlling and reducing water pollution, resource management, flood defence, fisheries, recreation and navigation. The Water Bill will also establish a new statutory framework for the control of drinking water quality and river quality. The bill will enable... When I've come to the end of this section... The bill will enable the existing water authorities in England and Wales to be replaced by new limited companies, which will then be privatised. The bill will also provide for the appointment of a Director General of Water Services to keep the services under review and protect the interests of consumers. I give way to the Honourable Member.
Simon Hughes.
If the Prime Minister and her government are so committed to the environment, why is it that she is privatising the water industry, making the private consumer pay a considerable amount more, according to her Minister of State, rather than shouldering the burden of expenditure on environmental improvement by government, where the public wish it to remain, and retaining the water industry in public ownership, where the public overwhelmingly have argued that it should stay?
Mr. Speaker, the government has only the taxpayers' money. Honourable members speak as if there are some other source of money. If we want environmental improvements, and we do, and there will be soon environmental improvements made for water with regard to nitrates, yes, it will cost money, and it will be the person who wants those improvements in water who will have to pay for it. And it's totally and utterly irresponsible to suggest we can have those improvements without being prepared to pay the price for it. An electricity bill will be introduced to privatise the electricity supply industry in England, Wales and Scotland. In England and Wales, in order to promote competition, the CEGB's generating capacity will be split into two companies. The area electricity boards will also be privatised as 12 independent supply companies, and the national grid will be transferred to a new company jointly owned by the suppliers. In Scotland, there will be two independent companies broadly based upon the existing Scottish electricity boards. In England and Wales, we aim to maintain the proportion of electricity produced from nuclear power at the current level, which would mean four more nuclear power stations, including Sizewell, by the year 2000. I said we aim to. I'm quite well. Yes, but of course, if honourable members had been listening, they would have heard that. Maintaining the nuclear power at the current level in itself will help to mitigate acid rain. and the greenhouse effect, because one of the real culprits in the greenhouse effect is the vast amount of carbon dioxide that comes from burning coal in power stations. The two bills show our determination to secure the advantages of privatisation for each industry, their customers and the taxpayer, while at the same time making a major contribution to the establishment of improved environmental standards. The coming session will also include, under this same heading, Industry and Commerce, legislation to transfer the Scottish Bus Group to the private sector. This will give a further boost to enterprise in Scotland and will create new opportunities for employee participation, wider share ownership and investment, which, of course, honourable members opposite hate. A Companies Bill will be introduced to improve and simplify procedures for companies and to improve merger control. The Bill's proposals on merger policy cover voluntary pre-notification of mergers and provision for enforceable undertakings rather than reference to the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. I turn to the second area of legislation, that which concerns social measures. The House will recall that the School Board Scotland Act of 1988 extended parental involvement in schools. We now propose to introduce an Education Scotland Bill, which would extend freedom of choice, note extend freedom of choice for parents within the Scottish education system by granting them the right to vote for the removal of their school from the central management of an education authority. The bill would provide that such a self-governing school would remain publicly funded by direct government grant and would not be able to charge fees, would be run by a board of governors representative of parents, teachers and the wider community, and would retain its denominational character. I give way to the honourable gentleman.
Mr. Sillars!
Is the Prime Minister aware that this particular measure will be met with total abhorrence by the vast majority of the people of Scotland? And it will simply reinforce their detestation of her and her policies. And is she aware that in Scotland now, she's got as much credibility and legitimacy as her new pal General Jaruzelski's got in Poland?
With regard to the latter point, when the honourable gentleman was a member of the Labour Party, and the Labour Party governed Britain without a majority in England, he didn't complain then, and neither did we, because we believe in the United Kingdom. I recognise he doesn't. With regard to his comments on the Education Scotland Bill, of course he doesn't want to extend choice to ordinary people. He's a socialist. That's why he doesn't. A further important measure will be the Children's Bill.
Order.
It will reform the law on child care and family services. It will take into account the recommendations of the report on child abuse in Cleveland. Children are entitled to protection from harm and abuse, and innocent families from unnecessary intervention by the state. The bill will replace the existing fragmented and overlapping provisions on child care and family law. It will improve the procedures governing the removal of children from their homes in emergencies while strengthening parents' rights to challenge court orders. It will redefine local authorities' responsibilities towards children in need and address the difficult questions which arose in Cleveland of parental access and medical examinations. It will also implement reforms in private child law covering custody and guardianship. Taken together, these proposals will form a unified and consistent code in respect of the care and upbringing of children. Nothing could be more important, and I hope the bill will have the support of all sides of the House. Still
The Prime Minister has set out what might appear at the first glimpse to be progressive legislation. Will she give an absolute guarantee that every social services department in the country that today complains that it hasn't got the staff to monitor even current legislation Will she give a guarantee that every one of those social service departments will be given the money to ensure they have the staff to carry out that function properly?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that the money they receive takes into account those very, very important duties, and if some of them didn't waste money on other things, they'd have more money to give to those very important things. Not only the amount of money, it is the use, it is the good use and good way in which money is managed. A major local government and housing bill will also be brought
order.
Introduce in England and Wales new arrangements for local authority housing finance and home improvement grants and local authority capital finance. Additionally, the bill would give effect to a number of key proposals contained in the Widdecombe report on the conduct of local authority business. I turn to the
order
matters which are concerned with safeguarding the security of the realm and fighting terrorism. Section 2 of the Official Secrets Act 1911 will be replaced by a narrower and
defined
provision. Its aim will be to ensure that the criminal law penalises, and penalises effectively, only those who make unauthorised disclosures of official information which do unacceptable harm to the public interest. The House had an opportunity to debate the government's proposals in July, and the bill we shall introduce will take account of points in that debate and elsewhere. I believe that the new bill avoids what are generally accepted to be the unsatisfactory aspects of the old Act and provides a more effective safeguard against the unauthorised disclosure of information. A bill will also be introduced to put the Security Service on a statutory basis under the authority of the Secretary of State. The legislation... May I continue this? The legislation will set out the functions of the Security Service and will reaffirm ministerial responsibility for the service. It will replace the published 1952 directive to the Director General of the Security Service from the then Home Secretary, known as the Maxwell 5 Directive. The legislation will follow the structure approved by Parliament in the Interception of Communications Act 1985. This country owes much to the work and dedication of our security service. The government believes it is right to provide the service with the authority and clarity of a statute. I give way to the right honourable gentleman.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister, and I must say, at first sight, it seems a very great improvement. May I ask what it will mean in terms of accountability to this House?
She'll set up an agency.
In precisely the same way as the Home Secretary and myself have always been accountable to the House. Have always been accountable to the House. No, we do not.
Order!
But as the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, ever say anything about the operational matters, as the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, and the Right Honourable Gentleman knows that this side of the House always supported him in his decisions on the Security Service, even when his own side did not. May I just make one more point, because I have a lot more to say. I think it might help. I understand from what Mr. Speaker said that the opposition have chosen to debate Home Affairs tomorrow. My Right Honourable Friend, the Home Secretary, will be saying more about this particular bill, which we hope to publish tomorrow, so Honourable and Right Honourable Members will be able to see then precisely what is in it. To strengthen our defences against those who preach and practice violence, particularly in Northern Ireland, we're taking a number of steps in addition to those already announced. First, we shall introduce a bill to require candidates in local elections in Northern Ireland to sign a declaration not to support violence. It's deeply offensive to the great majority of people in Northern Ireland that there should be those who openly support and indeed advocate violence in local council chambers. The bill is intended to prevent such statements and activities. Secondly, we shall be re-enacting the 1984 Prevention of Terrorism Act, including the power to exclude known terrorists from part or all of the United Kingdom, as well as the power to arrest and detain those suspected of terrorism. The bill will also include new provisions in three respects. It will make it an offence to be involved in handling or holding funds for terrorist purposes. The police will be given new search powers to assist them in tracing these funds, and the courts will be able to order their forfeiture when a conviction is obtained. The provisions follow those used successfully against drug traffickers. And second, for Northern Ireland, the bill will also reduce the remission granted to prisoners serving sentences of 5 years or over for terrorist offences from one half to one third of their sentence. And third, the bill will provide that anyone out on remission from a sentence of more than 1 year who is then convicted of a terrorist offence will have to serve the full unexpired portion of his earlier sentence as well as whatever new sentence is given. These provisions will mean that those found guilty of terrorism will spend longer in prison. They should act as a further deterrent to those who contemplate acts of terrorism and violence. Mr. Speaker, the government is determined never to give in to the terrorist, but to do everything in its power to defend society against terrorism. We would hope that our determination would enjoy the unanimous support of this House. But I have to note that honourable members and right honourable members opposite have consistently voted against the existing legislation. I believe this is seen by the terrorists and their supporters as a sign of weakness. And I hope that those honourable members will take the opportunity to correct that impression and to demonstrate that they share the government's determination to deal firmly with terrorism by voting for the bill. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech reaffirms the government's determination. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech reaffirms the government's determination to maintain strong and effective defences while striving to break down the barriers between East and West. There is no contradiction between these aims. Indeed, they complement each other. It's a sense of security which gives countries the confidence to negotiate and discuss their differences. If we adopted the policies advocated by honourable gentlemen opposite, there would be no need for others to negotiate with us because they'd be able to get all they wanted without it. Fortunately, the government takes very seriously its responsibility to maintain and update our defences, especially while the Soviet Union's military strength continues to expand with ever more sophisticated weapons. The provisions announced by my...
On this particular point, would my right honourable friend realise there is some concern about keeping the level of conventional forces sufficiently strong to deter, as has been suggested in her last remarks? And there is also some concern about the replacement for the chieftain tax. Can she yet give the House any indication when we will have a decision as to whether the order will go to a British company, Vickers, or to the American company, General Dynamics?
Mr. Speaker, we are in the alliance trying to secure unified proposals to negotiate with the Soviet Union on conventional weapons, as my honourable friend knows. Secondly, with regard to the placement for the chieftain tank, a decision has yet to be made, but I do not anticipate that we shall be very much longer before we make it. And thirdly, the provisions announced by my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, in his autumn statement, mean that the defence budget will grow by nearly £1 billion a year over the next 3 years. And that's the measure of the government's determination to make sure that our forces have the most modern and up-to-date equipment, both nuclear and conventional. And I hope that those who criticise Britain for not being sufficiently European will reflect that when it comes to making a real contribution to Europe, both our financial contribution to the community and our military contribution to the defence of Europe beyond our own borders, we are second to none. Mr. Speaker, I was able to discuss many of these issues with Vice President Bush during my visit to Washington last week. I'm glad to say that he wants to see the special relationship between Britain and the United States continue in all its strength, including, of course, the arrangements for Trident, which is so vital to our defence. It was clear, too, from my talks that our views and those of the new administration on all the main issues of defence arms control and East-West relations will continue to be very close indeed. At the same time, Mr. Speaker, Britain is in the forefront of efforts to overcome East-West divisions. And my own recent visit to Poland, welcomed by both the Polish government and by Solidarity, indeed by everyone except the Labour Party, is evidence of that. What the Labour Party can't bear is that one can go to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, believing in strong defence, ready to speak up for our democratic beliefs and for human rights, and still receive a warm welcome. Mr. Speaker, the official visit of...
Order!
The official...
Mr. Dennis Skinner...
On the subject of travelling round the world, if the Prime Minister thinks it's right for her to spend, I think it's £5 million of taxpayers' money during the course of the past 9 years as Prime Minister, why is it that she's stopping the Queen from going to Russia?
As the Honourable Member knows, we do not discuss this matter. May I say, the matter has not been addressed in any way, any way at all. In any way.
Order.
It is totally hypothetical.
Order. The Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the official visit of President Gorbachev and Mrs. Gorbachev in December will be another opportunity to discuss how we can take forward our aim of more peaceful and stable relations, as well as to hear more about his plans for reform in the Soviet Union. The visit is further evidence of the weight which Britain's views on all these matters now carry in the world. It is the result of the government's success in rebuilding our economy, strengthening our defences and restoring our reputation, success which will make the years ahead great ones for this country. Mr. Speaker, the first session of this Parliament was the fourth longest this century. It enacted 44 government measures. The coming session will be shorter, but it is a full programme which carries forward our policies and our commitments in a number of important areas, and I commend it to the House. Yeah.